Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for August 27th, 2010.
The Science Update Podcast is produced by AAAS, advancing science, serving society.
There's a tremendous need for a good diagnostic test for ovarian cancer.
For every 1 degree drop in the temperature, the number of heart attacks increased by 2%.
The Tibetan adapted physiologically differently than the Andean Highlanders and differently than any other population that we know about.
The first number is the measure of the viscosity at the low temperature, and the second is the viscosity measurement at the high temperature.
This week, what those numbers mean on bottles of motor oil, a language translator for telephones, why heart attacks happen more often in cold temperatures, and a new test for ovarian cancer. But first, Suzanne Bard reports on new research into how some human populations have adapted to living at high elevations.
As you climb a mountain, air pressure decreases and the concentration of oxygen goes down. When most people travel to high altitudes, they compensate by producing more hemoglobin, the protein in red blood cells that carries oxygen to the tissues. But too much hemoglobin can lead to chronic mountain sickness. Physical anthropologist Cynthia Bell of Case Western Reserve University says that Tibetans live at high altitudes but don't suffer from the condition.
And one of the ways in which they have adapted is by having the same level of the oxygen of carrying molecule hemoglobin.
But they have to make up for this in other ways.
One hypothesis is that Tibetans are using a different avenue of adapting. One that focuses on enhanced blood flow. So the rate of blood flow is higher among Tibetans than, say, it is among sea level people. So we think that what they've done is they make a lot of a molecule called nitric oxide that causes the blood vessels to widen. So that would improve blood flow. I literally just came back from a study of Sherpas, who are Tibetans who left Tibet about 500 years ago and settled in Nepal, looking at their blood vessels to see if they have more of them, wider, bigger. So that's what many of us are focusing on now, is blood flow. Another hypothesis is there's some evidence that Tibetans and other people at high altitude have fewer mitochondria. That is, that their mitochondria that they have are more efficient somehow at generating energy.
Bell and her colleagues tested DNA samples from Tibetans to look for genetic differences. They found that they have a variation in EPAS1. That's a region of the genetic code that produces a protein involved in the expression of genes that are regulated by oxygen.
The Tibetans had an unusually high frequency of alleles, coding variants of that particular protein, that were not found at high frequency in other populations, such as lowland Chinese.
She says that the Tibetan adaptation appears to be unique, and other high-elevation human populations have developed different coping mechanisms.
The implications are very interesting for other populations. The other major population that has been widely studied is the Andean population. And the Andean population is characterized by a very vigorous hemoglobin response. So they have very high hemoglobins, unlike the Tibetans. And in fact, they have not undergone selection at this particular locus. So from the standpoint of thinking about evolution, it's an interesting contrast that one population, by chance, the Tibetans, took to altitude some alleles that were associated with low hemoglobin concentration, and those were selected for. And the Andean Highlanders apparently did not. So that's nice for us in terms of thinking about how not all populations are going to respond to the same stress in the same way.
Bell says the Tibetan population's genetic adaptation probably occurred sometime in the last 10,000 years, around the time permanent settlements appeared in the Tibetan Plateau. She says the research is the result of a collaboration of scientists from England, China, and the U.S.
Thanks, Suzanne. Ovarian cancer is one of the deadliest cancers, in part because it rarely gets detected early when treatments are most effective.
There's a tremendous need for a good diagnostic test for ovarian cancer because the disease is essentially asymptomatic at early stages. And unfortunately, by the time it's diagnosed, the prognosis is poor because the tumor is usually developed and metastasized by that time.
That's molecular biologist John McDonald. He and his colleagues at Georgia Tech are developing a new diagnostic tool that identifies the disease with high accuracy. The team used a specialized computer program to analyze the 20,000 chemical components in the blood of ovarian cancer patients and healthy controls.
When you ask the computer program to look at those 20,000 molecules and identify those that are diagnostically different between the normal group that you put in and the cancer group that you put in, and we came back with a test that was 100% accurate in distinguishing cancer patients from normal.
He says if the test is validated in a larger sample of women, it could one day become a regular part of an annual gynecological exam.
I think that it could be part of an annual exam. And since ovarian cancer is a disease that's most prevalent at perimenopausal or postmenopausal women, it would begin at around that age as women come in for their yearly exam. Unless you're in a family with high risk, meaning is there a history of the disease in your family? And then in that case, you might want to start getting tested earlier.
Next, Suzanne reports on the relationship between cold weather and heart attack risk.
Scientists have known for a while now that the overall risk of dying goes up when the temperature drops. Now, researchers have evidence that heart attacks are contributing to this cold weather mortality statistic. Epidemiologist Krishnan Bhaskaran of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine looked at the relationship between outdoor temperatures and the number of heart attacks occurring on any given day over a 4-year period in England and Wales. He and his colleagues found that for every 1 degree Celsius drop in temperature, the risk of a heart attack rose by 2%.
That 2% sounds like quite a small number, but because the whole population experiences these temperature drops, and also because heart attacks are common to start with, it does translate to quite a substantial number of extra heart attacks. We translated the 2% of increased risk to about 200 extra people having a heart attack for a 1 degree drop in temperature on a single day.
He says when it's cold out, the heart has to work harder, blood clots more easily, and blood pressure tends to increase, all risk factors for heart attack. He adds that people who aren't used to exercising may start shoveling snow or doing other activities which put strain on the heart.
Thanks, Suzanne. Switching gears now, science reporter Karina Wu answers a listener's question.
Science Update listener Donna Berlin of Columbus, Ohio wrote to ask what the numbers on a bottle of motor oil mean. To find out, we went right to the source of those numbers, the Society of Automotive Engineers, the group that established the grading system for motor oil. Gary Pollack, SAE's program manager of technical projects, says the numbers refer to the oil's viscosity. So on a bottle marked 10W40, the first number represents how well the oil flows at a low temperature.
Naturally, at low temperatures, you'd want a much thinner fluid and a lower viscosity fluid to ensure that it will flow to all the parts of the engine.
The second number represents how well the oil flows at a high temperature, typically measured at an engine's operating temperature, 212 degrees Fahrenheit.
There, you would like a higher viscosity because as the engine is warmer and hotter and the conditions and temperatures are higher, you want to make sure that the oil is thick enough to still protect your engine and lubricate the parts.
Pollack says different brands of motor oil with the same grade should have the same viscosity characteristics, but brands might differ in the additives they contain, ones that clean the engine, prevent corrosion, or even change the viscosity of the oil itself. If you've got a science question, call us at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT.
Thanks, Karina. Finally today, Justin Warner has a story about a very unusual cell phone.
As a military campaign in Afghanistan escalates, skilled translators of Afghani languages remain scarce. That's why the military's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, is developing an automated translator that's built into a mobile phone. It's called TransTAC, and Craig Schlenoff of the National Institute of Standards and Technology is project manager.
This technology is not meant to replace human translators. I don't think that you're ever going to have a computer-based technology that's going to replace human translators. Instead, it's supposed to give the military an option for when a human translator is not available. so that the U.S. military can speak with local civilians.
A similar system is being used in the field in Iraq, but it runs off a laptop computer. Here, all the hardware is packed into a handheld phone. When someone speaks into the phone, an embedded computer recognizes the spoken words.
Which is very similar to when you call a drugstore or a grocery store and talk into the phone and say, please transfer me to the electronics department. Same kind of technology, just to recognize what you say.
The computer translates your spoken words into text. Then it translates that text into the text of another language and uses voice software to speak the translation aloud.
There's no need for internet connection or any kind of connection with these phones. They all run within the phones themselves.
Shlenov's team has been testing the system on a dialect of Pashto, one of Afghanistan's two official languages, with improvised scenarios between soldiers and civilians. Examples include medical situations, door-to-door surveys, even sewage and trash management. Bilingual human observers judge the translations. Shlenov says the system isn't perfect, but it's better than the often clumsy online translators most of us are familiar with. That's largely because it's so specialized.
The thing that makes this unique is that it's really focused on the military. So there's jargon that the military use, there's certain phrases, there's certain context and scenarios that they often find themselves in, where these systems have specifically been trained for that purpose.
That said, Shlenov agrees that the software might eventually be adaptable into a consumer product, like a smartphone app that translates conversations between foreign tourists and locals.
Thanks, Justin. Well, that's all we have for you this week. Next week, we'll have a whole new set of exciting science stories for you. But if you can't wait that long, tune into the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. You can also check out Science Update's fan page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.